I'm Manolo Quezon, and this is the Explainer Podcast. The Longview Philippine Daily Inquirer, September 17, 2007, and September 20, 2007. Marcos in Retrospect by Manuel L. Quezon III. You'd have to be over 40 years old and closer to 50 to remember a time when Ferdinand Marcos wasn't the president yet. If you were born in 1965, the year he became president, you would have been 21 years old when you finally left the palace. Much of those 21 years of your existence spent listening to government propaganda telling you he was the greatest Filipino ever. If you were born when Marcos fled, you must now be 21 years old. Much of your existence spent being told that Marcos was the worst Filipino ever. Both you and your parents have grown up in the shadow of one man and his wife. Marcos was not a smoker. He was not known as a drinker. He didn't swear. The strongest expression of irritation people would hear from him was lintik. And he was not much more of a womanizer than most men of his generation and macho culture like to think themselves to be. He was not tall, but trim and athletic for most of his life, a marksman, orator, armed with a photographic memory. Surely we can agree he was a man of talent. We continue to disagree whether he used those talents for anything larger than his own ambitions. The dull bio data of his life, the one we copy and paste for school reports, doesn't force us to try to make sense of his life. Perhaps the most perceptive effort on this that I've encountered was written by an American, Lou Gleick. He wrote a slender, often quarrelsome book titled President Marcos and the Philippine Political Culture. The life of Marcos can be divided, said Gleick, into phases. Those phases mirrored chapters in our nation's development and that of the culture in which leaders and the led operate. Phase one was Marcos, the law student who gained fame. While standing trial for the murder of his father's political opponent, Julio Nalundasan, Marcos became the bar exam top-notcher. The Supreme Court summoned him because his grades were so high, the justices were convinced he cheated. He convinced the justices he had passed. Soon afterwards, he faced some of the justices again when his conviction for murder reached the Supreme Court on appeal. He won his appeal on September 21, 1940, a date he would immortalize 32 years later. Phase two is also the most mysterious. Death March survivor Marcos, the guerrilla Marcos. How much of it, as demonstrated by his medals, was true? At least part of it. Genuine photos taken right after the war showed Marcos with pretty impressive decorations on his chest, a Distinguished Service Cross, a Bronze Star, and a Purple Heart. Any veteran with those indisputable awards would be considered a hero, except that Marcos wanted to be the most awarded veteran, and some of his claims would become, to put it mildly, controversial. This phase, I'd like to suggest, contains a period often overlooked in the debate over his war record. That period is Marcos's intellectual, even philosophical development. In this, he was surely influenced by a statement to whom Marcos felt he owed his acquittal by the Supreme Court, Jose P. Laurel. Here's something President Laurel said in 1943. Quote, "The whole history of government shows that public affairs would be better administered and the welfare of the people better served in the hands of a moral and intellectual aristocracy. The people cannot be governors and governed at the same time. On the other hand, a good and efficient government, a benevolent government, may exist and continue indefinitely to function with admirable harmony when men of superior moral and intellectual endowments are in control of the state." End quote. Laurel also said that there were four rallying centers of our national unity: the flag, the constitution, the national anthem, and the presidency. Marcos, in his day, would try to leave his mark on all four. He changed the color of the flag. He unveiled a modern arrangement of the anthem during one Independence Day. He almost single-handedly wrote a new constitution, and he made his office, and thus himself, the alpha and omega of our government and society. The third phase was Marcos the elected politician. As congressman from 1949 to 1959, first in the liberal administration, given his first big break as a presidential assistant by President Rojas, then supported in his candidacy by his fellow Ilocano Elpidio Quirino, and then in opposition to the Nacionalistas. Then Marcos, the senator from 1959 to 1965, including being Senate president from 1963, and president-in-waiting after President Diosdado Macapagal promised to support him in 1965. Marcos, the up-and-coming politician, had three power bases: his generation of the UP Cadet Corps and the guerrillas, the fraternities, and the Ilocano vote. The fourth phase was President Marcos of 1965 to 69, and the incumbent president who achieved a landslide re-election in 1969 only to be embattled from 1969 to 1972 on all fronts. This was a time of social upheaval, where our deeply divided society tried to figure a way forward. As Leon Maria Guerrero, in his justification of martial law, Today Began Yesterday, wrote, and I quote, "The experience of the Filipinos had been of parties that were not parties, but unprincipled coalitions of the rich, the powerful, and the unscrupulous, of elections that were essentially meaningless exercises in fraud, terrorism, bribery, and demagoguery, of politicians who represented no one but themselves. The people's capacity for self-government had been trapped in a political mechanism that had not learned to work or control, and their capacity for indignation and generosity, sacrifice, and service to the country left to wither and decay," end quote. The solution, to Marcos's mind, was martial law. This was the fifth phase, the supposedly reformist Marcos, the one who wrote Today's Revolution, Democracy. Martial law was a time when, to borrow a phrase made popular today, many were prepared to give up some of their freedoms to move the country forward. Never mind that a conservative estimate is that 20,000 were rounded up when it was imposed on September 23, 1972, but backdated to September 21 for its symbolic value. It was a time whose official theme song proclaimed a new society, and boy, did everything change. The barrio, he decreed, would once again be known by its ancient name, the barangay. The government, including the courts, was reorganized. Private armies were disbanded. Rice and corn lands subjected to land reform. An entire country proclaimed a land reform area. Dissidents were locked up, the press carefully controlled, Congress padlocked, a curfew from 12 midnight to 4 a.m. imposed, and the streets cleared of crime. The old oligarchy was crushed, old dynasties deprived of power and privilege. Miracle rice was introduced. Infrastructure ranged from roads to bridges to wells and electric grids and cultural, tourist, and government structures. A new constitution was imposed, with the voting age lowered. Hugh Gleick says the reform phase ended in 1975 with the firing of Executive Secretary Alejandro Melchor. It gave way to the sixth phase, the dictator who set aside reform and increasingly concentrated powers in his own hands from 1975 to when Marcos combined in himself the offices of president and prime minister in 1978, and who then presided over massive corruption from 1979 to 1981. Marcos's new society became the new republic, officially our fourth. Gleick says the inaugural ushered in the seventh and final phase of Marcos's political life. Marcos as the ailing dictator whose regime began to unravel from 1981. From 1983 until his fall in 1986, he finally lost touch with reality, was ousted, and exiled. Oddly enough, these are seven stages for a man whose lucky number was seven. Foreign observers such as Ian Baruma would say this, quoting a shrewd observer like Adrian Cristobal along the way. What Marcos and the First Lady wanted more than anything else was to be king and queen. They wished to shape the kingdom in their own image, Like the Sun King, Louis XIV, Marcos wanted to be able to say, "L'état, c'est moi." According to Adrian Cristobal, Marcos sees the Philippines as a society of tribes, and he sees himself as the great tribal chief, the Datu of pre-Spanish times. He destroyed much of the old network of family and regional loyalties to become the one and only patron, the king of Maharlika. Gleick argued, convincingly I think, that to understand Marcos, his strengths and weaknesses, requires understanding the culture in which he operated, a culture he tried to master but which ultimately mastered him. This is how Gleick described our political culture. The Philippine political culture is personalistic but violent, religious but superstitious, corrupt but tolerant, hierarchical but distributionist, solicitous of form but not of content, legalistic but careless of equity, media-obsessed and nationalistically vociferous with respect to rights but negligent to obligations. Marcos also once said that Filipinos will accept any kind of radical reform provided it is constitutional and legal. Whatever he might do, he did under the cloak of legality and proper form. Never mind if the substance came to be eroded by ill health and cronyism. Until late in his regime's life, many were content to ask, "What is your alternative and who will you replace him with?" to justify their continued support. It was only when the economic gains came crashing down in 1982 to 1984 that the public decided it was fed up with having no freedom and no more economic gains. Gleick wrote bluntly that Marcos's strategy was steal first, buy later. He did it so well that people came to admire his daring. Nothing breeds success like more success. James Hamilton Patterson quoted an unnamed associate of the president saying, "I sometimes think he became bored. He was very greedy. Yet it wasn't ordinary greed. I think he became bored a year or two after martial law because he didn't really have that much daily governing to do. I quite favor the idea that crony capitalism, as they call it, began when some of those cronies began to work out cunning schemes with him, and he was seduced by the intellectual challenge of it. He really wanted to know what he could get away with. It's a Filipino trait, this constant testing to see how far we can go. He loved all that." In the end, as Marcos's health and grip on power weakened, he came to validate what is said to be the fundamental weakness of all strongman regimes. As the saying goes, nothing grows under the shade of a great tree. Marcos could not, would not, provide for a successor. And it was on the fundamental question of what should come after Marcos that his regime began to crumble and fell. Why do we look back at the lives of people like Ferdinand E. Marcos? As long as humanity is around, the fundamental question will always be, how is power gained, maintained, and ultimately, for what purpose is it wielded? And that he himself, with his virtues, and he had many, love of country, love of learning, discipline, loyalty, and his defects, confusing form with substance, ignoring how the means power is acquired is as important as how you use it, tolerance of his supporters' mistakes, and his using armed force to compensate for some political weaknesses, are as much about our society's strengths and weaknesses as they were about his own. That was Marcos in Retrospect by Manuel L. Quezon III, Philippine Daily Inquirer, September 17, 2007, and September 20, 2007. You've just listened to an audio long read, an occasional feature of the Manolo Quezon is the Explainer podcast. Thanks for listening.